Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest in health and healing. We're going to share with you how higher levels of nutrients can improve your brain volume. Also, what B12 and folic acid does for memory. New information, if you've got any kind of peripheral nerve injury, which millions do, how the omega-3s can help that. Good information on something to help your eyes. And magnesium is tied to lower stroke. We have a lot on health. And then a more in-depth discussion from George Randall from Life Extension about how we can get more polyphenols into our body. Very important. That'll be like a classroom on the air. Two issues today. They're both short, but I'm going to ask you to call in and share your points of view. One is from Lee Fang, called "Why Can't You Smoke Pot? Because lobbyists are getting rich off the war on drugs." This is interesting. And from Professor Rodre Tremblay, "The Corrupt Influence of Money in the American Political System." They're both short, but important, so we'll deal with them. My guest early on in today's program will be Professor James Gustav Spath, and he has been one of the true insiders and leaders of the environmental movement for the past 40 years. For a decade, he was the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University and is now on the faculty of the Law School at the University of Vermont in Burlington. He was one of the co-founders of the National Resources Defense Council and chaired the President's Council on Environmental Quality under President Carter. And we're going to talk about, and this is also a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, America's operating system of governance is simply a failure. It does not address or help in any way our environmental, social, economic, and political crisis. Not at all. And it's time that we face this. Why is this important? Because virtually all the other programs that I see, either on the left or the right, will say that we have problems, but then suggest or even directly demand that the existing political powers deal with them. And I'm saying our entire political system is broken. It is corrupted. It has been taken over. And I will talk about this with Professor Spath on this Conversation with the Remarkable Mind series. Then my own short commentary today. I've been listening now about all the good news about our economy turning around and lower unemployment levels and the higher jobs being created. And therefore, we should be optimistic. I believe that that is nothing more than propaganda. So a brief commentary on the shocking statistics, actual government statistics, that the public has not been given that shows that things have been getting worse in America and not better. So that's our program. As you can see, we have a lot to cover. Let's begin. Most vegans do not have adequate B12 or folic acid. Most Americans don't get enough B12 either. The older you get, the less likely you are to have B12 in your system. Now, according to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they just did an analysis of an important study where folic acid and B12 improved immediate and delayed memory in older men and women. They had 900 people in this study. They gave them 400 micrograms of folic acid and 100 micrograms of B12, or a placebo, for 2 years. And they found that cognitive function was substantially improved. Now, here's my thoughts on this. I would never give anyone that little amount of B12 and folic acid. I believe that there should be 1 milligram of B12, 1 milligram of folic acid or folate in methylated form. Then I've seen remarkable improvements in people's memories. So they were right to do the study, and they did have positive effects, but they were way too conservative in how much they were putting into the people. So take your B12 and your folic acid and improve your memory. A new article published in Neurology by a group of physicians shows that in this group of people, cognitive improvement improved once a person had higher levels of nutrients. And a multifactorial nutrients like vitamin B1, B2, B6, B12, vitamin C, D, and E, folate, omega-3 fatty acids, when you had these in combination, you had, quote, greater brain volume and better cognitive function, having an increase in plasma level of trans fat, however, was associated with reductions in both brain volume and test scores. Now, as this is a major study, here's what it means in lay language. Think of the average person just today. Think of people sitting at home watching television. What kind of ads are they likely to see? Well, how about food ads like pizzas, trans fats? How about for pretzels or potato chips, trans fats? French fries, trans fats? Most buns that are on burgers, trans fats? Lots of trans fats. What this study is showing is the more trans fats you put into your body, the worse cognition becomes. You simply lose your awareness of yourself spatially wherever you're at. But when you have more vitamins and minerals that you would find in a high-quality vitamin mineral supplement, you actually improve cognition and actually improve brain volume. So that's all good. That's why those of you who've been taking your supplements, keep doing it. You're doing the right thing. Also, we now have a study done at the Mayo Clinic and published in their proceedings that says the following, quote, higher vitamin D levels correlated with less depression. Now, that's especially true when people are not getting it, adequate amounts of vitamin D in the from sunshine in the winter months. So my suggestion is that if you cannot get outside, then make sure you're taking 2 to 5,000 units of vitamin D3 each day, and you could help less depression. For those of you who know someone with leukemia, here's the latest from the University of Pennsylvania, and they found that fish oil was able to hold the key to the leukemia cure. That's what this says. And so I'm suggesting that if you know someone with leukemia, as part of their overall protocol, get them the omega-3 fatty acids 3 times a day. This was done by a professor of immunology and molecular toxicology in the Department of Veterinarian and Medical Sciences, and that's where the results came from. Also, omega-3 improves peripheral nerve injury recovery. This is in the Journal of Neuroscience. Researchers at Queen Mary University of London report that the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids can help protect peripheral nerves from injury and stimulate recovery. Well, think of all the people who have peripheral nerve damage, and that's very important, because otherwise you're going to have muscles atrophying, you're going to have pain, and so it could help you. Again, I suggest 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams once or twice a day. Magnesium is tied to a lower stroke risk. This is in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And this was an important study, and this is what it says. They looked at 241,000 participants in this meta-analysis, and they found that the higher the magnesium intake, the less chance of a stroke. That's good. I'm going to suggest 1,000 milligrams of magnesium citrate, C-I-T-A-R-T-E, citrate, each day. I also suggest 1,000 milligrams of calcium citrate each day. From Neurobiology and Aging, vitamin D rejuvenates aging eyes. This is very exciting news because it shows, this was done by Professor Glenn Jeffrey and his associates, University College London, that in this laboratory experiment, in just 6 weeks using vitamin D3, giving one group vitamin D3, another group no vitamin D3, they found, quote, an improved vision. So let's start taking our vitamin D3 because it also decreases amyloid beta buildup in blood vessels, including the aorta, which is the major vessel that carries blood from the heart. So make sure you're getting your omega-3 fatty acids again. Now, a little more in-depth discussion. I believe that we should be having, once a day at least, a health drink, and there are many ways you can make it, where if you're detoxing and you want to live a longer life, get yourself a bunch of apples. Now, there's two ways of doing it, so you waste nothing. On the one, I'd like for you to peel the apples. Let's say peel the skin off 4 or 5 apples and throw that into a blender with other nutrients, like a teaspoon of coconut oil and flaxseed oil and maybe some almonds or walnuts, pistachios, raw. And then your compounding powders, your green powders and your red powders. Why? Because the apple contains what are called polyphenols. Poly, P-O-L-Y, phenols, P-H-E-N-O-L-S. And that's been connected to living a longer life. But I'm going to get into greater depth on this in just a moment. Now, then take the rest of the apple and you can juice it. Or you can put it in a low-heat dryer and dry it and have nice dried apple that you can put into a cereal or take as a snack in a little bag with you and nosh on. So anyhow, here's what we have to understand. There are hundreds of studies now about polyphenol molecules, but specifically those from apples. And we have found that in these experiments, they can extend the lifespan by 12%. Now, if this could be extrapolated to humans, and I believe compounding it, meaning taking the best of the apple and other superfoods that have also been shown to repair DNA, slow down the aging process, lengthen the telomeres, stop oxidative stress, rebuild tissue. And we have a whole list of those, from L-carnosine to goji berries and acai. There's no reason we can't add 30 years onto our active lifespan as of today. Now, the older you are, the more of a challenge it is because you already have so much damage. But you can undo most of the damage you have. So even if you're 70 years of age, there's absolutely no reason, if you really become committed to changing, you could add, let's say that you would live another 8 years, the average lifespan, even for what we call a healthy senior. There's no reason that you couldn't live another 20 years in ideal health. So instead of dying at 78, you would die at 98. But then I don't believe that's going to happen, because I believe that in the next 20 years, much of the research that we've been doing, because it takes them about 30 years to catch up where we are, that they already will have caught up and be out there giving us the benefit of what the best chemistry can do to reverse the aging of the brain, the heart, the eyes. And I believe that's coming. But right now, this is something we can do today. Now, here's what we know about just the apple polyphenols. The initial findings show that polyphenols, quote, modulate multiple signaling molecules to delay the onset of age-related disorders. They may also mimic the actions of calorie restriction, a known anti-aging technique. One polyphenol, called flizardin, which is heavily concentrated in the skin of the apple, also potentially suppresses several processes leading to glycation. And you've heard me talk about glycation. Soft chicken going in, heat, combining with the proteins, and then a stiff, browned, non-functioning protein molecules after cooking. Well, think of all the foods you cook that are brown, like meat and chicken and fish and pork and bread and bagels. All that is glycated products. So this particular chemical can help slow that whole process down. Now, in 3 different laboratories, scientists conducted initial investigations, found that the use of apple polyphenols increased the lifespan by 12% in these particular studies. So, I believe that we could realistically say that if we were to include more apple in our diets, and I know some of you are getting those apples because I know some of you are using your red powders, and I know that apples are high up in the list of what you're getting. So let's just review here for a moment. First, let's take a look at the unique polyphenol, and I'll spell it for you. Filler, P-H-L-O-R-I-D-Z-I-N. Filaridzin. Now, it's in the skin. There are a lot of other polyphenols, by the way, and they're in very high concentrations. But apple skins contain that one, and it's especially active against glycation, one of the most common preventable reversible causes of aging. And it attacks glycation and its destructive effects at many different levels. So here's what we had to know about polyphenols. One, all aging results from the accumulation of tissue damage from just small handfuls of reversible causes on a daily basis. So let's say you're an average person and you're not intentionally trying to age yourself prematurely or hurt yourself, but you start having your comfort foods. But you think, all right, I'm going to have my pizza or I'm going to have my hamburger, but I'm going to have some vitamin C or I have something else to neutralize it. A, it doesn't work that way. You have to give up what you don't like that's unhealthy for you and embrace what's healthy for you all the time. And I believe that's completely doable. Because if not, then oxidative stress and inflammation and glycation are going to be what's going to make you look older, feel older, and have your body's organs start to tick-tock out of life. Next, polyphenols derived from apples can prevent and even reverse the effects of inflammation, glycation, oxidation. And these effects produce measurable results in preventing chronic age-related conditions, heart disease, cancer, high blood pressure, and even serious infections. And here's how polyphenol works. And by the way, you can get polyphenols in grapes. You can get polyphenols in blueberries and raspberries, strawberries, blackberries, goji berries. So it's not just apples. But we know that apple polyphenols help prevent colon cancer. A polyphenol is a large complex molecule. It's found almost exclusively in plant products. And these molecules possess unique chemical characteristics that include the ability to powerfully scavenge and reactive oxygen and nitrogen species, blocking oxidative damage that leads to inflammation and leads to biological aging. But polyphenols are more than just free radical scavengers, like an antioxidant. Depending upon the specific type and source, they also modulate gene expression. That means in lay language that polyphenols with unique characteristics can be chosen to address specific disease processes. And that's why I believe that we have to have them in multiple forms. For example, I know that apple polyphenols help fight infection and boost immunity. In fact, apple polyphenols bind to toxins produced by the bacterium Staph aureus, inactivating them and preventing their deleterious effects. It helps prevent toxic shock syndrome and massive food poisoning. In fact, one of the very first things that happened when anyone says, gee, Gary, I had some food and I feel really bad and I have diarrhea, I say, okay, take the skins of 10 apples, then take cabbage, blend up the apple skins, juice the cabbage, add aloe vera, cayenne, grapefruit seeds, take the actual seeds of the grapefruit and blend them and drink that. And suddenly the person, oh, wow, you know, look how much better you feel. Yeah, because you're stopping the particular microorganisms because that's how powerful they are. So that's why we should be having more polyphenols. But not to worry. Those of you who are using your red and green powders, you're getting a lot of that. So you're way ahead of the curve. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to give you two of our issues today. They're short. And then you can call in. Then we're going to go to our guest. Here are the two issues that I feel we should be paying some attention to. The first is from Professor Rodri Tremblay. And he says the following. I'll quote this. 2012 U.S. presidential election is the first one to be held under the new electoral financing rule decreed by a majority of one by the Roberts Supreme Court on January 21, 2010. With this fateful decision, the Roberts Supreme Court really changed the meaning of the U.S. Constitution that we says, quote, we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union, and decided on its own to change to we the rich corporations of America. Under the new Supreme Court rule, indeed any legal entity can spend as much money as it likes to control propaganda channels in order to influence and even dictate the election of the U.S. president and the members of Congress. That's legalized corruption. Sooner or later, this nonsensical decision will be overruled, but not before it may have caused irreparable damage to the United States political system by violating two basic democratic principles, the inequality of citizens and the principle of one citizen, one vote. There is no other democratic country where the dictum of the French economist from the 1800s applies more concretely. Quote, when plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men living together in society, they create for themselves in the course of time a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it, end quote. From now on, Americans will not have the most competent and the most dedicated politicians, but the best politicians that money can buy. Where are the men and women of value, of independent minds, who would want to run for office in such a corrupt system? In conclusion, as of now, with the uncontrolled flow of money coming from corporations, casino owners, and banks, and more specifically from defense lobbyists, from pro-Israeli lobbyists, from Israel firsters, from bankers lobbyists, oil lobbyists, and 40,000 other registered paid lobbyists in Washington, narrow special interests have free rein to use the resources of the state as if they were their own and to threaten any individual candidate or office holder who dares to oppose them. Keep in mind that the pro-Israeli lobby AIPAC, the most powerful single political lobby in Washington, D.C., was the main driving force behind our 2003 military invasion of Iraq by the Bush-Cheney administration, an illegal war of aggression based upon lies and false premises. Indeed, in such a system, the party and the candidates with the most money can be expected to prevail and place their pawns and yes men and women in positions of power. This is a throwback to the corrupt robber barons era when a handful of rich capitalists formed a greedy political ruling oligarchy. Undoubtedly, there will be exceptions, but money and propaganda are bound to dominate American elections in the future. That's him. What are your thoughts? What would be your solutions? Getting all money out of elections? That's mine. All money. No money allowed at all. And only 3-month election cycles? By lottery. Let people share their points of view so you can read them. Let people debate one another by lottery, so everyone has an opportunity to share what they believe is an important way of helping our country. And then you can read up on the person. And that way they don't, one person, a cab driver, a school teacher, a social worker, a police officer, a baker, has the same opportunity, if they have the right ideas, to be given a mandate to make change as just those who are more often than not wealthy business people or lawyers who have powerful people behind them who we never really know, who get them into office and have to pay back those favors. And this is the second issue. This is from Lee Fang, Republic Report, and it's short, but again, something worth noting. First, my own point of view. I've never used any drug. I don't moralize about it. I'm not making any condemnation towards anyone who has. I just don't want anything that I know would be harmful to go into my body. That's why I've never drank or smoked or done drugs. However, I absolutely believe that drugs should be legalized. I believe our for-profit prison system that has been privatized should be stopped. I believe that we have to be honest about the failure of our war on drugs, like our war on poverty and our war on almost everything else we do. We lose. But those who are smart and know how to game the system and who have political influence end up always ending up with money coming supposedly to help us with a problem, but we never look at the results. We only look at the great platitudes that people say how we're going to eliminate something, and only it increases. And those people who are part of the system profit from that? Do you really want to take someone in Florida who has 3 ounces of marijuana and put them in jail for 10 years? What exactly does that do to society, and how does that prevent that person from harming society, or how does it end up impacting that person? We seem to care not about what happens when a person's convicted, because we're certain if they were arrested, they must be guilty of something, because we don't arrest people without there being a good reason, right? Wrong. This is his comments. John Lovell is a lobbyist who makes a lot of money from making sure you can't smoke a joint. That's his job. He's a lobbyist for the police unions in Sacramento, and he's a driving force behind grabbing federal dollars to shut down the California marijuana industry. I'll get to the evidence on this important story in just a moment, but first some context. At some point in the distant past, the war on drugs might have been popular, but not anymore. The polling is clear. But beyond that, the last 3 presidents have used illegal drugs. So why do we still put hundreds of thousands of people in steel cages for pot-related offenses? Well, there are many reasons, but one of them is, of course, money in politics. Corruption. Whatever you want to call it, it's why you can't smoke a joint without committing a crime, though, of course, you can ingest any number of pills or drinks completely within the law. Some of the groups who want to keep the drug illegal are police unions that want more members to pay more dues. One of the primary sources of cash for more policing activities are federal grants for penalizing illegal drug use, which help pay for overtime, additional police officers, and equipment for the force. That's what Lovell does. He gets those grants. He also fights against democratic mechanisms to legalize drugs. In 2010, the California considered Proposition 19, a measure to legalize marijuana and to tax it as alcohol. The proposition gained more votes than Meg Ryan, the former eBay executive and Republican gubernatorial nominee that year, but failed to pass. Opponents of the initiative ran ads, organized rallies, and spread conspiracy theories about billionaire George Soros to confuse voters. Lovell managed the opposition campaign against Proposition 19. He told Time magazine that he was pushing against the initiative because, quote, the last thing we need is yet another mind-altering substance to be legalized, unquote. But Republic Report reviewed the lobbying contracts during the Proposition 19 fight and found that Lovell's firm was paid $386,350 from a wide array of police unions, including the California Police Chiefs Association. While Lovell may contend that he is sincerely opposed to the idea of marijuana legalization, he has constructed an entire business model predicated on pot prohibition. Shortly after President Obama's stimulus program passed, Lovell went to work challenging the taxpayers' money for California and getting it into drug war programs. According to documents Republic Report obtained from the Police Chiefs Association, Lovell helped local departments apply for drug war money from the federal government, and they got it. There is big money in marijuana prohibition. Lovell represented a police union in a bid to steer some $2.2 million into a marijuana suppression program. In 2009 and 10, California police unions sought $7,537,389 chunk of federal money for police to conduct a, quote, campaign against marijuana planting program. The anti-marijuana money went directly into the paychecks of many officers. For example, police departments in Shasta and Tama counties formed a California eradication team and received $550,000 in grants that helped pay for overtime, a new officer, and flight operations. Well, the federal anti-marijuana honeypot might have dried up if Proposition 19 had passed. Legalizing marijuana would have generated billions in tax revenue for the state of California while also reducing victimless crime prosecutions. But for lobbyists like Lovell, legalization was a direct assault on hundreds of thousands of dollars in potential fees for helping to solicit taxpayer money for his clients. Of course, police unions aren't the only interest groups with a stake in maintaining broken drug laws. The beer industry, alcohol corporations, and prison guard unions also contributed money to help Lovell stop Proposition 19. Howard Woodridge, a retired police officer who now helps push for legalization as a citizen advocate, told us that the drug company lobbyists also fight to keep marijuana illegal because they view pot as a low-cost form of competition. Li Fang is senior investigative journalist for Republic Report and is a former investigative blogger for thinkprogress.org. Those are issues. What do you think we should do about legalization of drugs and legalization of marijuana in particular? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Null. We're going to go to our guest in just one moment. Just one quick program announcement. Actually, two. This Sunday, there will be thousands of us marching to stop our spread of nuclear technology and power plants in the United States. We have 104 of them. We have written definitive reports on why they are not economic, they are not ecologically friendly. Just with one example, there are two plants, there are two reactors at Indian Point, 28 miles north where I'm at in our studio in New York City, and they each require about 1.2 billion gallons of water out of the Hudson each year, killing over a billion fish. What happens if there is an earthquake? What happens if the solar storm is as bad as what some anticipate in about 12 months, the Carrington effect from 1859, and causes the reactor to shut down, causing a meltdown, causing a Fukushima-like episode? What would happen if some other accident caused? How would we get people out? We couldn't. There's no way to evacuate 20 million people within 50 miles of that plant. So why are we not hearing the other side of the story? Why are the mainstream media not allowing those who have looked at the evidence to present a fair and objective, more scholarly and scientific appraisal of it? So we are massing together to protest. I will be there. I will be one of the keynote speakers, but there will be other speakers. There will be musicians. It'll be a wonderful afternoon of celebrating a group effort of all political backgrounds, all ideologies, coming together for the common public good. That's what we like to do. My documentary, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Our Nuclear Legacy, will be handed out to people who are there. I'm going to guess how many are there. Hopefully I'll have enough copies. Now, I'm going to be speaking at 3:30. However, people are going to be marching to an endpoint, which is a 6-mile march, over a 2-hour period, which is easy to do. And if you're going to meet at the ShopRite, the train station in Croton, the Harmon stop, H-A-R-M-O-N stop, which is off the Hudson Line on the Metro, Metro North Railroad, the ShopRite is a quarter mile away from the train station, 1:30. All right? Otherwise, I'll be at Indian Point at 3:30, and hopefully a lot of you will be there with us. If we have as many people come to this who came to our protests outside the governor's office, we will have thousands there. So I look forward to you being there this Sunday at 3:30, or joining the march to get there at 1:30. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null. My guest on the phone for a continuation of our series on Conversations with Remarkable Minds is Professor James Gus Speth, S-P-E-T-H. I gave you his background earlier as one of the true insiders and leaders of the environmental movement for the past 40 years. He is also the author of many books, the last being The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Stability. And his new article on his website is America the Possible, a Manifesto. And we'll get to that in a few moments. Nice to have you with us again.
Hi, Gary. It's good to be back with you.
Thank you. I'm going to give you a little larger let's say, a larger window to answer and address our issues from any of the things I suggest now. And then I'm going to stay quiet and have you address them, all right?
All right.
I'm very concerned that in the United States today, our government and its agencies are not doing the best job at helping confront our environmental, social, economic, and political crises. And as a result, I don't believe that they are politicians in running for office or in the White House or in Congress are looking at our environment. I believe that the powerful influence of the profit motive is now deflecting their attention and resources, and more is put on the corporate and financial interest rather than what we need as citizens to have a sustainable future. And finally, the way of our lives today, from my personal and subjective position, has been extremely materialistic. Everything is commodified and hence commercialized, and anthropocentric at the expense of dealing with our environmental problems. I believe that we look at economic growth and do not look at whether or not that growth will allow us to have a quality of life that we can do in a more natural way. Could you please address these issues?
Well, that's a big agenda. I think one way to address them is to think about where we now stand as a country when compared with other leading countries. We have let things in the U.S. across a wide front slide to the bottom. If you look at about 20 advanced industrial democracies, and then you look at about 30 key issues that characterize you know, how well off the people and the environment are, we're at the bottom of the list on almost everything now. The U.S. has the highest poverty rate, it has the greatest inequality of incomes, has the lowest social mobility, it has the lowest score on the index of well-being of children, it has the most discrimination against women. We have a long list of healthcare problems, which you talk about a great deal, and I won't repeat. We have near the lowest scores on math, and we have the highest homicide rate. You mentioned the a moment ago the issue of drugs. We have the world's largest criminal inmate population in our criminal institutions. We have the lowest score on the environmental performance index and the largest ecological footprint per capita, and the list goes on. And so when you have such encompassing problems that go across society, the economy, the environment, our politics, and you mentioned this terrible decision, the Citizen United case that the Supreme Court handed down that's unleashed the super PACs. When you have problems across such a broad front, you have to ask yourself, well, you know, it can't be due to small reasons. There's something fundamentally wrong when the system is failing to deliver across such a wide array of issues. And I think that something is there's something we're pointing to. We live and work in a system that prioritizes growth and profit and power, and it doesn't prioritize people and planet. And while there's a lot of things that we need to do immediately before we can really change the system that we have, we need to begin in earnest now to build a new political economy, a new operating system for our society, not the socialism of the past and certainly not, you know, the variety of consumerist corporate capitalism that we have today, but a really new operating system. So I love the slogan, system change, not climate change. And I think that what that means is that we've got to get serious about a host of issues that aren't really very much on the agenda now. We've got to find ways of dealing with our problems by other than simply trying to raise GDP number and increase the growth rate of GDP. We've got to think about the design of new corporations that can slowly and intentionally, you know, replace the type of corporate form that we have today. We've got to shift from Wall Street to Main Street in terms of banking. We've got to do something about this terrible problem of gross inequality in our society. We need new indicators of well-being that look way beyond GDP.
Such as Nepal.
Yeah.
Quality of life.
Good for Bhutan, you know, with their... Yes. Where their gross national happiness, and it's beginning to catch on in its own way, and people are doing indexes of well-being that are based on subjective conditions of how people are doing. And you know, we need to focus on at the community level. Some great things that are going on in our country today, when nothing good is happening much in Washington, is the great thing that's going on is that a lot of communities are taking up their problems at the local level and integrating social issues and environmental issues and launching transition initiatives at the local level. And you know, and the list goes on of things we need to do, but certainly very high on that list, in my judgment now, is something you were getting at, which is pro-democracy political reform. We have really got to move fast to save our democracy from this creeping corporatocracy and creeping plutocracy that is just engulfing our political process as we speak. And you know, you mentioned one idea for doing something about that. My favorite is the legislation. It's actually in the Congress to create a Fair Election Now law, as it's called by some, to create a combination of small donor financing and matching and government support at a level that can really make a difference. As long as the court is in the current mind that it's in, we're not going to probably see anything that's going to change the ability of the rich to put a lot of money into politics, but we could build up an alternative path to running a successful campaign through small donor contributions and public financing, and that's a very promising way to go, I think. But it's one of a number of things we need to do to increase the strength of our democracy and to make it a vital citizen sovereignty again. So that's just some reflections on your opening question. I know that a number of the things that I talk about in the article that's in Orion magazine and in the book that I have coming out on these issues in September, is called America the Possible: Roadmap to a New Economy. In today's politics, some of these ideas are, you know, just not off the table because the right has moved so far and so fast to the right. But the fact is that you know, if we go back to the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt and the things that were that came forward from the New Deal, you know, this basically what I'm urging is. You know, going back to extending those ideas and building on that base for the future. And, you know, we can be a great country. We can stop this decline. You know, we can salvage our democracy. Right now, we've been moving for some decades in the wrong direction. And as I said at the outset, we're back in the basement now of the well-to-do OECD countries on almost everything that's important.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Two quick questions. They're not immediately connected, but I'm curious. On the one hand, you were a part of the Carter administration and the Clinton transitional administration. You were bringing your background. You were an insider. But then you began to become more critical of some of the policies, including those of some of the administrators. Now, by some measure, you are considered almost a outsider who is an insider. Have you found any personal animus or criticisms towards you because you have, in effect, almost become a whistleblower?
I don't feel that. I do have a little story to tell because I did spend 40 years sort of as a, you know, in the sort of progressive establishment, I guess, of our country, and in those working for Carter and in Clinton transition and working in the UN and other things. But when I went to Yale to be the dean of the environment school there, I had a chance to really reflect on on where, you know, what was whether we were succeeding environmentally, for example. And as I looked more deeply at the problems, you know, you can identify the 10 big global scale environmental challenges, and there's only one of them where we're really succeeding. Things look really bad in terms of climate and fisheries and biodiversity and forests and toxics and other problems. And so the further I looked into it, the more I began to doubt that we were tackling these problems in the right way. It wasn't just that we needed more of the same. We needed to do something different. We needed to strike at the root causes of these problems. And at the environmental community, and I'm still part of it, and I'm still on some boards, and I relish my associations, but I think that they are making some mistakes too by not making a political reform a more central part of the agenda, by not engaging more directly in politics and grassroots organizing at the local level. And by not embracing and joining forces with other progressives to deal with these vast inequalities and inequities and injustices in our society. When 40%+ of the families in the country are living on incomes of less than twice the poverty threshold, half the country basically feels economically insecure. You're going to have a hard time making environmental progress in a country like that. And we also need to challenge this growth fetish that we have. Right now the only way environmentalists have to show that whatever they're going to do to save the planet is going to help the economy. And yet it doesn't really work. The economy is now out of the recession. The GDP is back where it was in early 2008, and yet we still have 15% of the people who can't get full-time real jobs. And growth isn't providing the jobs. We've had tons of growth in the U.S. over the past several decades, and life satisfaction is flatlined. Poverty has mounted, inequality has mounted, jobs fled our borders, and the environment has declined sharply. So growth is not the way to grow. Growth is not the answer. We need to deal more intelligently with these issues rather than just thinking that we can, prime the pump of aggregate GDP growth. It doesn't work.
I have one more question I think is relevant. In the last 6 months, I've invited some of the foremost environmentalists and sociologists and behavioralists and ethicists, philosophers on this program, many, I'm sure, almost all of whom you have met or know. And without exception, in fact, some very dramatically, have said the following, that they're finally arriving at a point that they do not feel it's possible to reform, even with the best of intentions, our existing political system, but rather they see to start working cooperatively with other people together so that when the inevitable collapse of some of the systems are in place, there will be a transitional period. It will be rough, but at least there will be some new, vital, more humanistic, more ethical, and certainly more equitable systems in place, even if they're informal and don't have the codification of official law, they will have a lot of adherence, like because they're working over the internet, they're working under the radar of the political system. But without exception, they're saying one of them, particularly the other night, said the co-founder of the Gorbachev Foundation and the Wisdom Institute said, I believe for years that we could reform the existing system. Now I realize that I was naive, that we can't, because it's just too heavily controlled by special interests, and the very people that we're asking to reform are going to make reforms only to the degree that they still have loopholes or advantages that don't fundamentally change anything, but have a nice veneer to them. And he said that he believes that we should be working together, cooperatively, everyone, instead of their own little individual areas, for the day when, in the not too far future, when our different systems begin to collapse and when we become even more fascistic, more limiting in our human rights and our right to protest, our right to habeas corpus. He said, if you think you're going to stop that, no one has been able to stop it or even slow it down. And every time we turn around, they're enacting another law that further takes away our rights. He said, they're not going to change this system. They're not going to change any of it. But sooner or later, because they will go to such a degree, so extreme, that they will cause what they have created to collapse on them. And then those who are of a more progressive mind will be able to step in and say, but there are other ways of now going forward. That's their view. They could be right or wrong, in part or whole. Could you give us yours?
Sure. Well, I in the article in Orion and in the book that's coming out in America the Possible in September, I go into this in some length. I try to present what I think is a theory of change, and it resonates with what you said to some degree, but I want to make one big caveat about that in just a moment. Because I think what's going to happen is that as conditions in the country continue to decline, or at best, fester like they are, the system is going to fail to, deliver on its promises and people's expectations, and the system is going to lose legitimacy. On top of that, I regret to say this, but I'm sure that there are going to be crises in environment and in the economy that are going to focus attention on the need for deep change. And in response, I hope and expect that the progressives, which are now very siloed and working on their own issues, will coalesce and find their voice and find their strength and pioneer the development of the alternatives that we need to build a new political economy. I think demonstrations and protest and nonviolent civil disobedience will increase as this process goes forward. And then at the local level, in particular, we see this happening around the country. You know, the future is coming into view as communities, as different types of corporations are formed and transition towns begin to deal with local problems. And so we see things happening at the local level to kind of represent the future. And those things, when people hit, when the crises begin to thicken, people will look around and see these positive models. So that's sort of what I see as the picture here. No. But I would just add one thing. Unfortunately, the climate issue is so serious and so fast upon us that we haven't got time to wait on systemic change and transformative change. If we don't find a way to deal with this climate crisis, things can become so nasty and brutish within a fairly short period of time that it could easily become kind of eclipsing other things, just dealing with the effects of climate change.
I would agree with you on that. In fact, last week we had three of the world's leading climatologists on, all professors, who said that four of the 12 tipping points are tipping. Nothing we can do about it. Some of the others, we can slow it down. We definitely need to do something. But unfortunately, look how long we've been talking about how the crisis of the environmental issues are upon us. And look at how each administration said they cared about the citizens, but did nothing formative against that. So we have to apply outside pressure with documentaries on environmental issues to force this into the consciousness of the American public, who then can mandate, get off your tough duff and do something, politicians, like putting surge protectors at all our nuclear power plants in case the solar storms coming are as bad as many anticipate, the plants will not melt down. There's a lot we can do. I thank you very much for giving us your time today. As always, you're just a fountain of insight. The America the Possible is the book. And, excuse me, The Bridge at the Edge of the World is the book, and America the Possible from OrionMagazine.org is the article from Professor James Speth. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. And for those of you who are listening just part of our program, I hope that this has given you some insights. For those of you who live on Long Island, out on the east end of Long Island, Knocking on the Devil's Door will air this Saturday at 3:55, Sunday at 10:30, and Wednesday at 4:25 on Channel 20 in East Hampton. And again, you can go to your listings out there for Channel 20, LTV, East Hampton, Saturday 3:55, Sunday at 10:30, and Wednesday at 4:25 to watch that. Joining me in studio now, as we go to the end of our hour on the internet, for those of you who are listening on land-based stations, terrestrial stations, we'll say goodbye. But let's say hello to Richard Polonesky and Richard Gale.
How are you, Gary?
Hi, Richard Gale.
Doing well, Gary. Just a quick announcement. We have our Progressive Commentary Hour approaching this Monday. It'll be March 12th, 7 p.m., and you're going to have another special program looking at the AIDS and HIV controversies. We'll get some updates and all. Clark Baker, who's been a guest before, but is former officer of the LAPD and now a private investigator. He's the founder of the Office for Medical and Scientific Justice, is going to be sharing a lot on more of some of the social issues that happening around the incarceration of people that are who have been diagnosed with AIDS, and the political and the justice system's failure to be able to look at it properly. Celia Farber, a well-known journalist and who won the Semmelweis Clean Hands Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism, will also be guests. And Liam Sheff, an investigative journalist who researches the scientific discoveries, the medical cult, the politics of scientism, dealing with infectious disease, AIDS, vaccines, prescription drugs, and he'll be a guest as well. And then just for next week, people can look forward to hearing Tracy McMillan, who was the author of the important book, The American Way of Eating, but you might know her even better now as being one of the latest victims of Rush Limbaugh's vendetta against women. So she will be a guest. We're going to have another conversation with great minds with Professor Harold Welzer. He's the head of the Institute of Advanced Study of Humanities, the University of Essen in Germany, who's become a scholar on the future climate wars that we're going to face, particularly more violent models that other guests have not quite gone to the degree that he has on this topic. And then Scott Tipps is he's the sole representative for our health freedom rights at the Codex Commission, and he will be in the studio, and he'll be speaking with us, too, on the assault on our access to supplements and vitamins.
Good. I'll be doing my Sunday evening show at 8 p.m. on Talkback, and Monday evening, 7 p.m., Progressive Commentary Hour, the most downloaded program that we're aware of in the United States. And for the hundreds of thousands of people listening to that program, thank you. Now, that's Richard Gale giving you a highlight of some of our best programs coming next week. Richard Polonesky. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Richard, we only have 2.5 minutes, so I'm not going to play any of the film, but on Monday we will. Richard, we are just approaching the Monday evening's premiere in New York of this wonderful film, as well as getting people to become aware of it. And one way they can become—we have to look at this as a three-month program. Stage one, make people aware that such a crisis among our vets exists. What is the problem? What are the solutions? So let's show them the trailer. You just put it up right now, I understand.
Exactly. We've uploaded it to YouTube, and it's officially up there. Now YouTube will do their magic and do their processing, and within the hour, people should be able, in about an hour, to search for American Veterans, the Scarred and Forgotten trailer, and see it up there. It's about a 10, 11-minute trailer, and it's the best of the best of the film.
Good. And it's a 2-hour and 15-minute film. It took a long time to produce and direct and write this, but it's done. So now for the 30 million veterans and the 70 million other family members, that's one-third of the American population, we have the problem and we have the solutions in one film. We want people to communicate. Stage two, after you become aware that there is even a problem and what's behind it, who's responsible, how did we get here, then stage two is watch the trailer. Then you can go to the website and purchase a copy of the actual film. Watch it. share that information, word-of-mouth sharing information, so people realize we have a real serious issue out there. And then stage three is unify the different groups, the organizations, and even on Sunday night now at 7 p.m. preceding my show, we have Dr. Doug Roeke, who has his own show, a Gulf War Vet. So now the Gulf War veterans have their own show to communicate on their issues, what's important to them, right on the Progressive Radio Network, 7 p.m. right here, preceding my show. So we're giving them a forum. We've got a documentary. We have articles written. Our campaign to help the vets is starting, and it's starting now. Go to, in the next hour, and download the trailer. It is powerful. Thank you for all your good work on that, Richard.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening.
Over.